Sure is, with Ben Cohen, author of The Hot Hand. And, of course, we'll take your calls and see how hot your hand is next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Ben Cohen's with us. Ben, if the hot hand, if it's not luck, if it's not part of the brain, part of us, what might it be?
Oh, I think it's all of those things. I mean, I think there is some luck, and I think there is something internal. There's an internal cadence that sort of meets with external circumstance. So I actually think it's sort of a collision of all of those things, of talent, of circumstance, and of luck.
If it doesn't work for people, why not?
Because they are not in control of their own situation. So I in the book, I take a trip to the border of Minnesota and North Dakota, and I meet a fifth-generation sugar beet farmer named Nick Hagen. And Nick is a really interesting, smart, fascinating guy. And Nick believes in the hot hand. He plays basketball. He watches basketball. He was actually he's a Juilliard-trained trombonist, so he's this incredible musician, and he knows what it feels like to be hot, you know, while playing his instrument. But one of the things that he had to learn when he entered his family business was that there is no such thing as the hot hand in farming, because he recognizes that a good year is sort of dependent on something as random as the weather. And so if he has a good year in his soybean crop on one patch of his land, and he decides to go all in and invest all of his resources on soybeans in that particular part of his land the following year, he could go broke, because in farming, like in investing, like in gambling, there is no effect from one year to another, not usually anyway, whereas in basketball there kind of is. And so I do think there are times when circumstances and environments are beyond our control and are not conducive to the hot hand.
For your first book, this was pretty good right out of the chute.
Not bad. Yeah, my timing wasn't great, but I hope that people will read it anyway.
Let's take some calls here for you. We'll pick it up by going to Joe in Long Island, New York, to get things started. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Ben, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, two questions, and I'll use tennis as an example.
Sure.
One is, if you're a tennis player, say you're number 30 on the national or international tours, and you've patterned your game on after a prior superstar, how do you continue modeling a game like that, or do you kind of go away from that slightly depending on what happens? And then my second question, also using a tennis player, say you rank 30 and you know you've won 3 out of 10 matches, so you want to shift gears and do something a little differently. Yes, but say you won 8 out of 10. You still want to shift gears like Rob Reiner did, kind of shifted gears into the Princess Bride. So the idea that you're shifting gears either way, whether you have the hot hand or not to some degree, either way, what would you say about that? And then
that's it. Those two, that's what you get.
Those are fascinating questions. Thanks very much. I do think it's perfectly fine to pattern your game after a more established superstar. It's just a matter of what the effects of getting hot might be. And so if I am a tennis player and I am trying to be Roger Federer, well, if I get hot one day on the tennis courts, like, that's just a nice memory. It's something for me to remember, and it's something for me to feel good about when I go home and go back to my day job. If Roger Federer gets hot and he wins Wimbledon and then he wins the U.S. Open, I mean, these are events that can sort of change his life, because he can use them, he can use the power of them in a way that I cannot. And so I think playing like Roger Federer is perfectly great. I just think it's important to not delude ourselves into thinking we can be Roger Federer or Stephen Curry just because we get hot one day. And then I think in terms of switching gears, I think that's a perfectly reasonable point. And I think that is sort of the fun of thinking about the hot hand. It's trying to figure out, like, what exactly it means for us and how can we apply it. And I think it means all types of things for all types of different industries and all types of different people. And I think that, like, perfectly reasonable people have come to opposite conclusions. And so I think it's just something that's worth meriting on and toying around with for yourself and seeing where you land. And that's sort of the beauty of this world of ideas.
Ben, when the hot hand, the streak ends, why?
Oh, God, that's the worst, right?
It is. And what causes it to end?
It could be a lot of things. It could be overconfidence. It can be arrogance. It can be simply regression to the mean. And I think the reason why it's important to take advantage of the hot hand when it does strike is that the one thing we know is that it does not last forever. It will run out, and we will go back to feeling terrible about ourselves or just being our normal state. I mean, when we are in the hot hand period, we kind of elevate to this superhuman version of ourselves, and there's just no more pleasurable sensation. That's why it sticks with us. And so I feel an added pressure even when I'm at work myself now. On the very rare occasion that I do feel hot, those are the days that I remind myself to work harder, to make that extra call, to polish that sentence and try to make it even better, because something is happening. Even if I don't quite understand it, the only thing I know is that it won't be happening forever, and I will regret it if I don't take advantage of it while I can.
Let's go to Brian in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hello, Brian. Go ahead.
Hello, George.
Hey, welcome to the program.
Your screener said he loves the game of bowling, so I hope you guys kind of understand how it works.
Okay.
But it's a lot like golf. And back in 1992, my brother shot like the fourth best World Series of all time. He had an 896 series out of 900.
Not bad. Almost a strike every time, right?
Almost, yeah. He had 300, 299, 297. And the first thing I asked him was, how did that feel? And he goes, I was in the zone.
Yeah.
And then within the next two or three years, I would hear Michael Jordan talking about his big game. He goes, I was in the zone. Another thing, positivity. I know some of the poker players that play now, like Phil Hellmuth and Mike Mattisau.
Giants.
On Twitter, they're always talking about positivity. Like in Vegas, of course, today's and maybe the next month, hopefully, it'll not be as bad. But they say, you know, when they're playing poker, they feel positive, they win. They feel negative, like, I'm done. Get out of here. I just kind of wonder what your guest thinks of that.
And we've got a guest named Joseph Gallenberger who conducts experiments with people in Vegas, Ben, based on attitude. And almost every time, the happy people, the upbeat people, win. The negative people lose.
That's interesting because one of the things that researchers have found about the hot hand is that when we are in the hot hand period, we enter this like flow state in which our minds are sort of flooded with dopamine, and it's sort of like when we're hot, our muscles almost feel like jello. You're in this like unconscious state. You are in the zone, as Brian says. And the hot hand, like the reason why we remember these flow states is that the hot hand makes us happy. Like there are activities that all of us have. For Steph Curry, it's playing basketball, but for Brian's brother, it might be bowling. For other people, it's swimming or knitting or, you know, anything.
Right.
The hot hand, when we are in those periods, that is sort of when we are happiest doing that. So I do think there is something to positivity in that sense and sort of having the belief that you can stay hot and you can take advantage of it while you can. And it's important to recognize that recognition. I keep coming back to it. That's the important thing. And I think there is some positivity embedded in that recognition because you have to be willing to realize that, like, you are transcending your own ability when you feel hot. And I think that, like, having the self-confidence to be aware of that and to recognize it and to realize it and to act on it, I think all of those things are related.
Can people train themselves to get in the zone, or does it just happen?
I think it just happens. If we could train ourselves, I would be one of those movie stars in a montage training myself right now, because I think that we all try to maximize our time in the hot hand and the number of times that we are in the hot hand. But, you know, I can't think of anyone better than the greatest shooter in the history of the planet to ask about the hot hand. And when I asked even Steph Curry, who's probably been hotter more, and in terms of his temperature, in terms of his hotness, probably hotter than anybody. Even he says he doesn't know when it's going to happen. So if anyone were to know, I think it would be him. So I'm going to go with
interesting
on that one.
When do they realize they're in it?
That's a great question. I think after you make two or three shots in a row in basketball, but again, basketball is not life. So I think it depends for everyone. I mean, for Rob Reiner, when studio executives are coming to you and saying, we'll make anything you want to make, it's a pretty good moment to realize that you're in it, right? But there are also times when people have realized that they're in it, but they can't really take advantage of it. The world is sort of conspiring against them, and I think that's equally important. And so, I think it's you kind of just know it when you feel it or when you see it, and I think it depends and it varies for everybody. I mean, for me playing basketball, it's different for Steph Curry playing basketball. For the first caller playing tennis, it's different than Roger Federer playing tennis. I think there's something very deeply individualistic about all of this.
Let's go to Mike in Denver, Colorado. Michael, take it away.
Good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Ben, thank you so much for your work. And I'm a big fan of your reporting that you did at the Wall Street Journal. And I look forward to reading your new book. A couple of comments and a question. First of all, there's a great movie that relates to the Hot Hand called One for the Money, and it was with Matthew McConaughey. And it kind of – he was a bookie in this movie, and he set up people's bets, and he ended up losing the bets eventually. And so it was kind of ironic. It's – I'm sure you've seen the movie, but that was just something that came to mind hearing you talk about the Hot Hand. I did have a comment on stadiums. So when you look at new stadiums, especially teams that feel that building a new stadium is going to kind of give them that manifestation of winning, and it doesn't always happen, ironically, as we've seen with the, Detroit Red Wings and the San Francisco 49ers up until this past year with the Candlestick Park move. It's an interesting kind of idea that building a new stadium will give you that role or that success. And I wanted to get your opinion on what you thought of building new stadiums and manifesting wins. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your very generous comments and for reading the journal. It's a really fascinating question. I haven't really thought about it in terms of the context of the Hot Hand. Ordinarily, I would say that I think that probably there is some something to the comfort level of playing in an old arena, a place where you are familiar, and that sort of leads you to the Hot Hand. But then again, players get hot on the road all the time in places where they are not necessarily comfortable or familiar with the environments. And so I don't know. I mean, clearly I think that sometimes you can feed off the home crowd, and it's important to have that stadium setting that you're familiar with. But sometimes guys just love going into road arenas and silencing the crowd. I mean, there is nothing that pleases them more. So I think it can kind of go both ways. I think if arena architects or if the teams that are plowing billions of dollars into these facilities could find some way to, like, weaponize the Hot Hand, they would. I mean, they would spend even more on it.
Ben, what's your take on the NBA this year? Is the season gone?
I think it's a great question, and I think it goes back to, like, that uncertainty. I mean, I think they would love to salvage it, to rescue it, and start the season again somehow in June or maybe even July. I think it'll probably depend also on whether the Olympics go on, because
right,
if they don't, then the NBA has some more leeway in the schedule. But there are a lot of really hard questions to the league in terms of, like, do you just keep going with the regular season? Do you go straight to the playoffs? Do you shorten some of the series? Do you go to semifinals and then a final? Like, how exactly do you do it? I think that, like, they don't know, and anyone who claims to know what's going to happen for the next two or three months is probably lying. I think they would love to make it happen, and we've never before had a season that ended so abruptly. So I think they're doing everything in their power, but again, like, they're not really in control here.
How busy is the Washington Post reporters on this year's election? Are they scurrying all over the place?
I know more about the Wall Street Journal than the Washington Post, but at the Journal, I think that like everyone is just going crazy. Although I have to say, like you know, clearly politics is part of this, but this is really one of the first stories that I can remember that really transcends politics in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I have to say, just from personal experience, I mean, I was watching the election returns roll in two nights ago, and just was looking at my news app and just kind of forgot that there was a primary that night, because this is so all encompassing that
it's unbelievable.
It transcends all other news and kind of dwarfs this primary election and general election that we've been paying attention to for two or three years. It just kind of seems trivial at certain times of the day now.
Those are the stock market reporters for your newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, must be aghast at what's going on.
They are running around.
Oh, my God.
I mean, they are the craziest people at the paper right now. I mean, there's a lot happening in sports, but, you know, these have been some of the most volatile, just absolutely insane days in the market in a decade and probably even much longer. So those are the real reporters at the paper. I just get to play around and write about sports.
David in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hello. Well, if the traders would probably say that they're not insane, I think that the traders themselves, the sharks and the marks, I think the sharks are making a lot of those ups and downs happen and doing it on purpose because they make money every cycle. Some experiences, maybe you can comment on fun ones first. I drove Jim Kelly's mom to the Super Bowl. I wonder if that was my fault. And I was once one-on-one with James Brown at a table in Vegas when he had a hot streak and won $700 in about 3 or 4 minutes, and then went up on stage and did his show. So that was a fun one. Now, to the serious stuff, there seems to be two sides of it. One of them, I've been meaning to comment to you, George, for a long time, because you bring it up, and like you just did a few minutes back about that experiment that somebody had done at Gellerman or something like that.
Gallenberger, yeah, in Vegas.
Yeah, my experience with that, what come to my mind is when I've had those experiences being hot or not hot at, for instance, at a blackjack table, I have found that you're correct. When you're upbeat in a good mood, that I win, and it seems almost effortless compared to when you're just in a normal, typical, average
yep.
mood. It's not like that. And what I have chalked it up to, and I may be wrong, but I may be right, is that when in order with blackjack, for instance, with the odds being like 51% against you, if you just play even and over a long period of time, you lose by 51-49. And so the way to win is you gotta play a larger hand, win, and time those right so that you're putting your bigger money down when you happen to win the larger hand. In order to do that, you need to be more confident than
That's
average,
right.
And then just get lucky, put the money down at the time when your cards come up for you. And that's how I've explained bigger winnings when you're feeling upbeat. On the skill side, here's a good one. I had a conversation with Kurt Schilling. I talked to him on the internet. He related an experience which jives with what my experience has been with throwing a ball, pitching, or hitting a ball, or shooting archery, or shooting guns. And he was relating his experience with Ted Williams, had come to the ballpark when he was retired, obviously, but came to the ballpark, and Kurt was pitching to Ted. And Ted started talking about how he could pick the spot on the ball where his bat was going to hit the ball, and all of the pro players were saying, you know, no way, it's impossible. And so Ted got a little mad, and he got out some pine pitch and rubbed it on his bat, some rosin, and put it on his bat so it would make a mark on the ball. And they took a brand new ball, and Kurt threw it to him. Fastball, and Ted Williams said
and he did it. He did it right on. Welcome back. Ben Cohen with us. His book, The Hot Hand. Ben, you know, when people are in the groove, they feel it. I have a feeling the planet is not in the groove right now. You know, I've always thought of the planet as a live entity by itself. I think it's out of the groove.
It's as the cold hand right now?
Yeah.
I think that seems to be a very fair assumption given the events of the world over the last week.
Absolutely. And I hope it finds its rhythm again and gets back into its streak.
I hope so, too. I hope for the sake of humanity that it does.
Well, Let's go to Mark in Monterey, California. Hey, Mark, thanks for holding. Go ahead. Mark, you there? Nope, he is not there. Let's go to Robert in Tucson, Arizona. Robert, you take it away.
Yeah, George, thank you very much. And earlier, your guest, Ben, was commenting about how the plague had been a causative agent for Shakespeare. And this is not really a question, it's just a statement. I wanted to point out that concurrently, a gentleman by the name of Isaac Newton was at Cambridge. And Cambridge, for the first time, I think, ever, had been shut down by the Great Plague. And it decimated the faculty. It killed a huge proportion of the students. Newton retired to his father's farm. And that is where he wrote the Principia, which is the basis of physics, the law of gravitation, Newton's laws. It's a huge treatise, many hundreds of pages, but most physics students basically know, well, I know Newton's laws, you know, and I just wanted to point that out for all your listeners of things that come out of calamities like plagues.
Interesting.
It's a brilliant observation, and I actually thought about writing about Newton and that particular year in this book, and I was actually down to Newton and Shakespeare in the chapter I wanted to write about the plague, and I was a terrible physics student, and so I decided not to write about Newton because I couldn't properly describe what he found. It was a bit easier for me to dive into Shakespeare. So you were right. It's a great point, and I was actually, the funny story is I was down to the two of them. It just happened that I went with the plays instead of the physics.
Tell us about the Vincent van Gogh painting story.
Yeah, this is actually the last chapter in the book, and this is something else I did not know. I did not know that like we are still discovering Van Gogh paintings in the wild. And so, not too long ago, 2013, a bunch of researchers at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam were able to verify a painting that was sort of a long-lost Van Gogh, except it wasn't exactly lost. It had been hiding in a collector's attic for the past 100 years or so. And the reason it was in this attic was because many years earlier, he had been told by his personal and professional rival that this new Van Gogh painting that he had just bought was actually a forgery. It was a dupe.
Oh, geez.
He was so embarrassed.
What a horrible thing to find out.
That he marched this painting up to his attic in shame, and nobody saw it again for about the next century. Now, the really delicious thing about this story is that these two people who were at the heart of this saga, the one guy who told his rival that this Van Gogh was a fake, they were both in the same business. They were in the business of making margarine. They were margarine tycoons, and I just love that they specialized in making something fake that was meant to taste real. And yet, like, they both had this question of, like, what is real and what is fake with this Van Gogh? And the reason it's in a book about the hot hand is not simply because of Van Gogh, although Van Gogh did have his own hot hand period in the summer of 1888. But the reason it's in this book is because that, to me, was a problem that was solved by looking at the question in a new light. Many years later, I mean, almost 100 years later, these researchers came along, and they were willing to look at this old, potentially authentic Van Gogh in a way that nobody had looked at it before. They didn't have any of these preconceived biases or notions. And to me, that's really important. It's important to question our long-held assumptions, even if for hundreds of years we think something is true. And that kind of led us to a different conclusion about the hot hand. And so I think they're tied thematically. And the truth is that I just love the Van Gogh story so much that I wanted to include it in the book anyway.
Let's go to George in Richmond, Virginia, east of the Rockies. Hey, George, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, good evening, Ben and George. I'm a piano player, and I tour about two-thirds of the time, and I learned about the zone from basketball, which is what I did previously to that.
Right.
And I got in the zone in basketball about seven times in 5 years, and one time I was playing so badly that I just didn't care anymore. I just said out loud, I don't care. And then I got hot for about 3 days. Huh. I learned about passing. And the minute, after about 2 days, I said, now, how do I maintain this? And then it evaporated away. And musically, I've been in the zone about five times. And I'm like, oh, this is like the basketball thing. I made a recording one time. And I didn't. My engineer said, come in and listen to that. And I go, why? There's nothing there. And he played it back. And I said, is that what I just did? I don't remember anything. And so I can't control it, but I usually don't even know when it's basketball. I never knew when it was happening. Musically, I kind of don't know either, but I also produce people. And there's one person I was producing that my engineer and I noticed that we started about 8 o'clock, and after midnight, he played things for a real long time. And he'd come in back in the control room. I'd say, well, what's the name of that? He goes, I don't remember what I did. So and that was after midnight. And so we learned to have him play, you know, long and play after midnight. So I kind of learned how to control the zone for that artist.
Well, that's pretty unusual to be able to control it, though, Ben, isn't it?
Yeah, I love that, though. I mean, one of the researchers I wrote about in the book actually studied the hot hand among monkeys to see if this was a trait that was evolutionarily ingrained into us. But what he said was that he also played basketball, and he was an athlete, and he sometimes played squash. And one of his squash partners had his own hypothesis about the hot hand, which is that whenever he felt good on the squash court, he would sort of take note of that. And then he would also take note of when he felt good in his research lab. And he found that, like, they tended to overlap, that, like, feeling hot, it sort of applied to different parts of your life. And so I would be curious if there are basketball players who also play the piano, if any of those
would be interesting
moments coincide, if a good basketball game can lead to like a brilliant piano performance, because it does seem like, you know, just from personal anecdotal experience, it does seem like that can be true.
We're going to Rough and Ready, California, population of 963 people, and here's one of them. Walter, go ahead.
Hey. Yeah, I was. I'm a basketball player. I played back before the 3-point line and before the shot clock. I averaged over 20 a game back there, and I've had a few hot hand experiences. But one time I was playing, and I couldn't make a shot. I couldn't hardly even get my hands on the ball for like it was about three quarters of the game.
Wow!
And halfway through the fourth quarter, I was so frustrated that I finally just said, "I'm going to pray. I'm going to ask God to help me in this game." And I said, God, please, just let me get my hands on the ball. Just let me get a shot. Oh, my God. All of a sudden, the ball started falling into my hands. Everything I put up was going through the hoop. I hardly even had a shot before that. And a ball actually bounced off of a guy's head into my hand, and I put it up. It was absolutely amazing. And and when the game was over, everybody, my teammates from the other team were coming up to me and going, man, what happened to you? You couldn't do jack. And then all of a sudden, you were on fire. And I was kind of afraid and intimidated, you know, that I didn't want to be them to call me a Jesus freak or something. This was back in those days. And I'm there, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to tell them the truth? Am I going to deny God? Or am I going, and chicken out? And I finally went, I said, you know what? If I do, he might never answer my prayers again. Or I got to be courageous. And I said, look, you guys asked me. I'm going to tell you what happened. I prayed to God and asked him to let me get hot in this game, and he did. And you know what? They looked at me and said, man, that is really cool. Not to a person. They all just said, that's awesome.
I love it. Do you find, Ben, that the less you really push and try, the easier it is to get in that zone?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, and maybe I should have written about divine intervention in the book.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I do think sometimes that is the case. Like, you don't want to be pushing too hard, and it can kind of it can come out of nowhere. It can appear when you least expect it. But I do think some of this, like when I talk about talent meeting circumstance with a little bit of luck, I mean, it also goes to like putting yourself in a position to get lucky and to take advantage when the hot hand does strike. So, you know, I do think that, like, you know, sometimes I find this in writing, sometimes like the best thing you can do if you're staring at a computer screen all day is to just like take the subway home and look at your document on your phone instead of the computer screen, and everything will sort of look completely different. And so I do think that change in mindset is important. But, you know, you do want to give yourself a chance to get lucky, to work hard, and to be able to take advantage.
Let's go to Greg in Cocoa Beach, Florida, first-time caller. Greg, go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. Hey, it's my first time. I'm very nervous, but I wanted to tell George that I'm a longtime listener right after the Art Bell days. I've never seen him, but I want to say that you are a super person. Sometimes I just wanted to tell you that, because sometimes you do these collections for like an old lady or something. It really makes me happy.
Oh, thank you.
But anyway, I wanted to say about the hot hand. I'm a major sports fan. I just wanted to ask Ben, I guess his name is, do you think it has anything to do with adrenaline rush or something to do with the chemicals in the brain? And I plan on being a caller for a long time, but thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it. You did a good job. Not to worry. Ben, what do you think? Adrenaline rushes?
No, it's a phenomenal question. I wish I could give a better answer. I think I said earlier that, like, I wish we could strap electrodes into the brains of Steph Curry when he gets hot to sort of see the different neurons firing and try to figure out what exactly is happening in that mind. I mean, clearly there is some type of neurological response. I mean, because that feeling of like unconsciousness, of being in the zone, it's different. It's not our normal state. What exactly it is, I can't tell you, because I don't think scientists have a great idea. I mean, I think it's probably something worth studying. And I think it is a great reminder that this field of hot hand studies, people studying and looking into every angle of this phenomenon, it's existed for about 35 years, but like this debate is not nearly over yet. And I think it's going to continue, and I think it's going to inspire and open up future lines of research that are just as interesting as what we've seen so far.
Is it easier to track an athlete, a sports figure, to determine the hot hand as opposed to somebody who is, you know, in the groove at work or in a relationship or things like that?
It is, because in fact, like, there are very few industries that are as neatly quantified these days as sports. If you think about it, like, you know, sports, you kind of know everything about an athlete. You know about his performance, even though, like, you're not his HR person. And so the beauty of basketball statistics and especially advanced data and the high-resolution tracking cameras that log every movement and motion 25 times a second that happen on basketball courts, it can tell you things that we didn't know, or maybe that we thought we knew but couldn't quite prove for sure. And that's how we discovered the hot hand. I mean, one of the great papers about the hot hand was actually published 5 or 6 years ago, and it was based on data from these high-resolution tracking cameras that were able to figure out, like, exactly the probability of the next shot going in. And so that was based on where the shooter was and where the defender was and how closely the defender was guarding the shooter. And, like, this is data that was not available to the researchers in 1985 in their nerdiest, wildest, wonkiest dreams. It was simply better data. It wasn't just bigger data. It was better data. And we're getting better data more and more, and a lot of it is coming in sports. I mean, it's why researchers and academics have loved studying sports, is because it can tell us something.
It makes it happen. Ben, thank you for being on the program. Good luck with the book, The Hot Hand. Up next, Joshua P. Warren, as we dabble with the supernatural in just a moment.